Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's press conference, where he publicly staked out his position in the ongoing negotiations as the Republican-generated debt ceiling crisis looms. Economist James Galbraith joins us to assess what the President has already put on the table in terms of cutting programs considered Democratic sacred cows, and what compromise he is likely to get in return from the apparently uncompromising congressional Republicans. Then we will go to London to speak with veteran Fleet Street reporter Philip Knightley about the burgeoning scandal that is being called Rupert Murdoch's Watergate, following the latest revelation by the BBC that Murdoch's minions were digging up dirt on former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, presumably to threaten or blackmail him. We'll look into divisions within the Murdoch media empire and how much public outrage might embolden politicians to lose their fear of the political kingmaker who can either make or break their careers. Then finally, veteran Los Angeles Times investigative reporter William C. Rempel joins us in the studio to talk about his new book, At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. With Guatemala already a narco state and Mexico fighting a war against narco terrorists, we will discuss the extraordinary financial and political power drug cartels wield and how their malignant grip on a country was broken by one man. I'm now joined by James Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be back with you.
And it would seem that today, to some extent, President Obama may have turned the tables in the sense that the Republicans have been painting him into a corner, or perhaps they've been painting themselves into a corner on this debt crisis. How much do you think there is leverage in the threat that he issued today that he will not sign a 30-day or a 60-day or a 90-day extension, that he would veto such a bill?
Well, I think that was a shrewd and sensible move, because nobody wants to go through this on a continuing basis. So what he simply did was to say that he would only accept a deal that raises the debt ceiling by enough to get us well past the 2012 election. And that, I think, is quite reasonable. Then the question is, what kind of deal can we possibly imagine that would be acceptable to all parties? And I think the facts of the matter there are that the president has already offered vast concessions, vast cuts in programs that should not be cut for this purpose, while getting essentially so far nothing in return. The Republicans are basically saying they will not be party to anything that so much as caresses a hair on the head of any of their wealthy backers.
So, who they now call job creators.
Yes, the wealthy job creators. Yes, that's what we're talking about for sure.
So, but obviously, it's puzzling to understand why the president has allowed himself to either drink the Republican Kool-Aid or at least accept their narrative in tying the economy to the debt crisis, which was entirely generated by the Republicans themselves.
Well, the debt crisis was generated. I mean, the debt crisis. First of all, there is no debt crisis.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
The debt ceiling is is being reached. It needs to be raised. It has been raised many, many times since it was first enacted in 1917. It's a bad faith piece of legislation to begin with. It always was a kind of thing that was there to reassure the rubes back home that you were being responsible, when in fact you were doing what was necessary and issuing bonds to cover public deficits. But that aside, there is no crisis here. The federal government is not in danger of defaulting. It is not paying. It's paying an extremely low interest rate, even on very long-term bonds. It has no. It is not going to become Greece and cannot become Greece. So the whole question of a crisis is this simple artifact of the expiration date or the date at which the Treasury reaches the current statutory debt limit. Nothing else.
Well, in an environment, James Galbraith, where I think you could fairly make the argument that the Republicans prosper from a bad economy and Democrats will suffer because of a bad economy, who would win in this case of calling the other's bluff? If the president vetoes, if they make one of these offers of these temporary fixes and he vetoes it, and then we pass the August 2nd deadline, if the economy goes into the kind of tailspin that it will, and the global economic structures will be shaken to their roots, that'll just make the economy worse and make the Obama and the Democrats' elections prospects in 2012 even worse than they are now.
This kind of interaction between politics and economics is, I'm afraid to say, far over my pay grade. The problem that I have is that completely lost in this discussion is the need to do something with the condition of the economy that we have now, where we have 9% unemployment, we have a continuing crisis of foreclosures, falling property values, a whole host of serious problems, and a slowing growth rate, plainly visible in the current data, completely without this, complication of the debt ceiling debate. But what we're getting out of the debt ceiling debate is a set of concessions from the White House already on the table that will, over a very long period of time, make things markedly worse for millions of working Americans as they get older and they need Social Security and Medicare. If we get, for example, a change in the way in which Social Security cost of living adjustments are made over the long term, what that means is that the oldest and the poorest of retirees will suffer the most. That is not a concession, I think, that any reasonable person would make to anybody, even if it were something that was required to get past this particular hurdle. It is taking leading with or conceding the interests of your most vulnerable people and people who have worked all their lives on the assumption that this very modest body of protection, Social Security and Medicare, would be there for them when they are elderly and can no longer support themselves. So I'm saying that this is it is not constructive for the economy to do this, and it is in many ways a dreadful statement about the current state of the leadership of the Democratic Party that Democrats are being asked to make those concessions.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, Professor of Economics at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Predator State. Now, of course, Social Security, there is a Social Security fix, not the one that apparently has been offered on the table.
Social Security doesn't need to be fixed.
Well, no, in the sense that Senator Sanders and others say if the wealthy paid a little bit more, then any possibility of a long-term problem with Social Security.
I have a great deal of respect for Senator Sanders. I know what he's driving at. But the reality is that if you left Social Security alone with the existing commitments and the existing tax rates, the world would go on just fine. The interest rate will not be one iota higher as a result of doing that than as a result of raising the payroll tax on wealthy people in order to have more revenue coming into the federal fisc. And the two problems are totally disconnected from each other. And
right.
So I think it is a mistake to say that there is this alternative Social Security fix. Social Security does not need to be fixed. It should be left alone.
Well, I was going on to say, though, that we're heading in the opposite direction in the sense that as for what we know about the compromises that John Boehner offered up and then reneged on, was that they would allow the tax cuts for the wealthy to expire. But apparently that's only going to bring in $800 billion to $1 trillion of the $4 trillion that's being put on the table. So that looks like the Democrats are giving up 3-1, doesn't it?
Well, the Democrats are giving up on the spending side something over 80% of the total package. So this is a concession, which is a prospective deal, which has already been heavily weighted toward what the Republicans claim to want. Whether the Republicans actually do want this or not, I think, is an open question, because obviously they got up and walked away saying, no, they didn't. 83% wasn't good enough. They wanted 100%, which is something that they're not going to get. So, you know, what their deeper motivations are, and I say bless them for walking away from the deal, because I don't want to offer them the 83%. And I say recoup that, take that back from the table, say that was once off, and now we're going to have to deal on some entirely different basis. The right way to resolve this issue is for Congress to face up to its responsibility and pass a clean increase in the debt ceiling, period, end of story. A clean, substantial, long-term increase in the debt ceiling. That is the right way to deal with this. This is a totally artificial crisis. It's being ginned up for political purposes. And in doing that, the Republicans in Congress are acting in plain violation of the very clear language of the Constitution of the United States. They're doing something which the authors of the Constitution, 14th Amendment, Section 4, foresaw would be extraordinarily destructive to the ongoing government of the United States if people were allowed to get away with it. That's the problem. It is, in some sense, what we're seeing here is an extra-constitutional attack on the government of the United States, and a president who is not facing up to the reality that that's what he's up against.
Well, it feels like extortion within blackmail, within a great deal of chutzpah. I mean, just to be realistic for a moment, as you've pointed out, the debt ceiling is a phony crisis generated by the Republicans. Nobody, by the way, on the Democratic side appears to want to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment, but it's there in plain English. If the Republicans really cared about the debt, how come the last three Republican presidents, Bush Jr. and Senior, and President Reagan, ran up over half of the entire debt in the entire life of the Republic, and George Bush in 8 years, one third of the entire debt? I mean, you could actually make a different argument. It's actually that the Republicans are the one who not only put us in debt, but want to put us in debt. They're the ones who want to break the federal government.
Well, creating a national debt is not the same thing as breaking the federal government. The federal government needs to create debt for certain purposes. It will create debt in any event when it's faced with a severe economic downturn because tax revenues fall. And to say a nice word about George W. Bush, which doesn't happen to me often, on the one hand, he came into office in a recession that he did not create. That certainly created debt. And later on, at the end of his term, the financial crisis, which he has a great deal of responsibility for, forced the creation of a lot more debt. These things happen, but the debt itself is not the cause of a crisis in the life of the Republic. The crisis in the life of the Republic is the unemployment rate that we face now, the foreclosures that we face now, the fact that the middle class in the United States is losing its hard-won financial wealth as the value of its housing falls to less than what they owe on it. These are the problems that we face. In addition to that, we have an energy problem. We have a climate problem. We have all kinds of issues that we should be dealing with. We have a decayed infrastructure that we should be rebuilding. The debt crisis, the so-called debt crisis, is a pure distraction from this, ginned up as a kind of, as I say, constitutional or extra-constitutional coup d'etat. And the president needs to face that reality. He's in a tough position. But the Democrats, when you say they will not invoke the Constitution, they are in complete dereliction of their responsibilities. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Well, but the part of it that's so puzzling is how the Democrats have already lost the narrative, how they've allowed the state of the economy to be linked to the debt when it's a phony debt crisis. And the reality is that the economy is getting worse, the recovery stalled. Job creation is what we should be talking about. We don't have a deficit crisis. We have a revenue crisis, and everything would be solved with people going back to work. And now we learn that close to $2 in every $10 that goes into Americans' pockets come from federal payments, from unemployment, food stamps, Social Security, disability, etc. And that about $37 billion of this money is going to be drained from the nation's pocketbooks this year, making the problem even deeper. So we're actually heading in a direction where the recovery is getting stalled and throttled, and yet we're having this ridiculous...
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. What's happening here and what is being proposed is to cut back on those sources of income which are helping ordinary Americans to make ends meet. And in addition to that, the federal government, the total governments, federal, state, and local governments, have lost about 500,000 public employees since President Obama took office at the beginning of 2009. And that's not his fault. That's what was inflicted on states and localities, mainly, by their revenue crises. But the notion that the economy is better off because those 500,000 teachers and librarians and fire and police and so forth are not working, whereas they were, It's bizarre.
Well, what we don't really know exactly what's been offered. There's an indication that maybe one of the concessions was on Medicare to raise the threshold from 65 to 67 when it kicks in. We don't know exactly what went on in Vice President Biden's negotiations, but we understand that there were cuts offered in farm subsidies, student aid, federal workers' pensions, and domestic agency budgets, but that Eric Cantor walked out because he didn't want tax cuts, tax breaks for oil and gas companies, and deductions for the wealthy at cut, and he resisted the Democrats' efforts to cut the Pentagon. So... That looks equally lopsided, the Biden plan.
Well, I think that the game of offering cuts in vital public services and protections, which have no economic policy purpose, no purpose is served by raising the age on Medicare, except that you will have more medically bankrupt people between the ages of 65 and 67, which are ages when many people are vulnerable to sicknesses that they can't afford to pay for the treatment for. That's what Medicare is there for, to protect them from that. So why are we transferring to those people the cost of this particular political negotiation? It makes no sense to me. I would stand firmly in defense of those people, recognizing that there's nothing lost by doing it. It's not as though the interest rate is going to be any lower than it presently is if you make that concession than if you don't. The two things are just, from an economic standpoint, totally disconnected from each other.
So, just in closing, Professor Galbraith, do you think that, I hear you say that the president should take advantage of the Republicans' uncompromising attitude, but he's already given up so much. It doesn't look like it would be great if he would take all that stuff off the table, but
I think the president is engaged in a political game to make himself look reasonable, to make the other side look unreasonable, to make himself look like the more serious deficit hawk, to make the other side look like they're not serious. These are political games that he may or may not win. That's his objective, not mine, and not, I think, the objective of the larger public. If the essential social programs of the United States that have been in place since the New Deal of the Great Society, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are compromised in this process, if crucial government functions, transportation funding and all the rest, are cut completely needlessly, as a result of this. And if the Constitution of the United States goes down the drain as a result of this, opening us up to an endless series of blackmail negotiations over the future, then I say history will not look favorably upon the presidency of Barack Obama, irrespective of whether he wins this political game or not, which he may well do.
Yeah, but in the short term, if all of those things are done, the recovery will be even more remote and less likely.
Oh,
and
that's true, too. Yeah, no, that's true.
I mean, we're talking about
from an economic standpoint, sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's his immediate political survival.
I think to be fair on that, you know, if you're cutting Social Security 25 and 30 years from now, this is not going to have much effect on the economy right now. I mean, we're not talking there. We're just doing something that we should not be doing, that we do not need to do, and for which there is no benefit, except, as I say, these possible political optics that everybody seems to be so concerned with.
Well, I'm sorry that politics overwhelmed economics in this discussion, but that's what we're facing.
It is, indeed. It's the same.
Thank you for joining us, James Galbraith.
As always. Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James Galbraith, who's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go to London to talk with a Fleet Street veteran.
I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. I never thought about love. When I thought about home, I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. The floors are falling out from everybody I know.